Hello and welcome to the Tavern Chat Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Tenkar, and this is another of our series of designers and makers fireside chats. Fireside chats because we don't do interviews, we sit down with friends. With me today is Kevin, also known as Your Pro GM. I believe that's also your Twitch channel.
That is one of my Twitch channels, yeah. And I'm hoping to do more with it than I have up right now. What I do is kind of private, you know, like private sessions and stuff. So I don't have a lot of media out there.
All right. Well, Kevin's our guest today. Now we're going to jump into our five questions. And then, as is usual, we will start the hex crawl. Kevin, tell us about your first RPG experience.
So it's kind of interesting. I feel like I'm usually one of the youngest people in a group of players, at least with the places that I've networked and that kind of thing. Most people, you know, they played the original game or, you know, some of the stuff like pre 90s and that kind of thing. Yeah. Well, my first RPG experience where I was kind of like creating the story outside of, you know, just playing around in the yard with the people. I actually was playing in an IRC chat channel. I had found, like, the internet was crazy. When I got our first gateway computer, and I was on, like, Yahoo when it still was basically, like, a message board. I loved video games. So I would just look up stuff about different video games I liked. And one of them was Mega Man. And so I stumbled upon this website that was doing both play-by-post and live IRC role-playing for Mega Man. They had kind of put together a pretty simple mechanic system. And, you know, we were actually, like, rolling dice at our desk and that kind of thing. And, I just went into an IRC chat channel and met some people, and you kind of put a real simple kind of character together. And I did that a few times, and it really just sparked everything else, just research into what an RPG was, because I didn't really, the only context that I had at that point was that I had played RPGs on Super Nintendo. Like, I'd played Chrono Trigger and Super Mario RPG, so I was like, that's what an RPG is to me. But then I went, did more research and like into the history and that kind of thing. And I was like, wow, this is the thing. You know, it's like making your own stories and, you know, creating your own thing and, you know, creating people and places and the ideas around them. That was the way to go.
Well, you really came in with a non-standard RPG. Listen, the bread and butter is somebody came in with some version of D&D. There's been a few exceptions. But to come in with basically a homebrewed system that you found via the early internet is pretty damn cool.
Yeah, and then after that, there was like a local hobby shop, and they were kind of like the collectible cards and the war games and that kind of stuff, as most hobby shops have to be to, you know, stay in business. But they had RPGs and stuff too. And so in the back of the shop, they would play. And I was still really young. I was like, you know, 11, 12 years old, right? But I did go to the back part of the shop a couple of times and played with them. Played some Battletech the first time. And then the second time, they were actually, that was my first exposure to D&D, and that was AD&D. And I rolled up a character. It's kind of the typical story, you know. You roll up a character, session zero for you. You play a little bit, and then I had actually skipped out on a Taekwondo class to go over to the hobby shop, so I didn't get to go back to the shop for a while.
That's classic. Well, then, obviously, your introduction to gaming was pretty cool and pretty unique. But these days, what's your go-to RPG system?
So the one that I've worked with the most is D&D 5th Edition. because of my pro GMing and what they had done when it comes to supporting the product, made it easy to kind of go in there and do some performance, tell people about what I was doing, and then, you know, found some clients from there.
Fair enough. That makes sense, too. I mean, 5e is certainly the RPG system that, was it Rising Tide Lifts All Ships? It's certainly been the one that's brought this hobby back to life.
Yeah, I've really been, I was happy with when they did the D&D Next playtest. They did a lot of iteration in there, some good ideas. And I mean, some of the ideas that didn't make it to the final version of what's in the book are still in like Unearthed Arcana and on the website and that kind of stuff. So a lot of good rules variants.
Yeah, I was part of the D&D Next friends and family part of the beta testing. And
so you were right in there super early.
Oh, we were in there too early. I'll be honest with you. Because we initially enjoyed it, and here's the problem too with us, I think, is that we were like, hey, we're going to use these rules to actually start like a campaign. But every 2 or 3 weeks, the rules would change, and they wouldn't just change from like, I don't know, from A to A1. It would change from like A to Y.
Right,
and it would be a total flip of, and after doing that for, I'm going to say 2.5-3 months, the group burned out. Our DM especially burned out, I think. Right. That was part of the issue.
Right, and you got all those mechanics things. I mean, you can't really stay consistent, even with the world. It's going to feel different.
Yeah, it was really frustrating. So then we went from that to me GMing, and I think when I came back to GMing for the first time, like 15 years at that time, ran Osric and Venture Conqueror King. Those are the two games that I wound up running initially, and I wasn't going to try doing Next at that point. That was the group that was frustrated like that. It's like that. Oh,
that
isn't gonna work.
Yeah, I saw it. What was it? I got right in when they sent out the beta material to the wider audience, and it was. I think it was like, yeah, it doesn't sound like what you're talking about. It sounds like they had really kind of stumbled on the advantage disadvantage thing, and
I'm not even sure if we actually had that mechanic in it and during our time of playing with it.
Right. So I did I did some playtesting with the Keep on the Borderlands module that they put out and like redid, just text and everything. And I was doing some testing with that with some friends. And I was so hyped for that product to come out.
I think that's something that many people don't realize either, is that when a beta goes public, when the public beta goes out, like when Pathfinder puts out its, or published its public beta for Pathfinder 2, at that point, the vast majority of the rules are locked down. They're trying to find major issues that maybe weren't found with the localized play. But for the most part, an open beta is like it's like a stress test. But it's also, I did narcotics as a cop in the late 90s, and it's also like giving out that free piece of crack. You're giving people a free taste, and with that free taste, you're hoping that you're going to get lifelong customers.
Sure, and I would say, if I was going to say anything to Wizards of the Coast and how they've handled D&D, I would just say that... I mean, I know that they're a book and playset company, and that's like something that drives it, and that's why they've kind of branched out into the tabletop games like Lords of Waterdeep and that kind of thing. I think that's a great move for them because they're gonna be people out there that copy things and you know, hack things and that kind of thing. And what they have to understand is that they have to, as a company, do something that adds value beyond what people can copy for free. And I know that a lot of stuff you can copy for free now. I mean, we got Tabletop Simulator. We've got, what do you call it? You know, you just, the PDFs, just the printed material, you know, something that, you know, a magazine used to be a way to make money. And now a magazine is marketing. And that's like pure marketing. And that's just what it is.
Yeah, you know, times change. And that's something that certainly has changed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now you came in at least to the Dungeons and Dragons world of things with AD&D. Did you ever experience Basic Expert?
I did not until very recently. Well, actually, no. How recently is very recently? I played with Jonathan Henry. He's he ran was one of the moderators of the G+ tabletop role playing community, and he would run Gamer Chat, which was a Google Hangouts. It was by invitation, but it wasn't hard to get an invitation. It was basically just you had to like see the thing, and if you saw the post, you could join it. And so it was awesome. Like you'd have some people that were designers come in. You'd have some people that played a lot games journal, like RPG journalism, that kind of stuff. Can't really think of names off the top of my head, but it was supposed to be kind of like a sit down at a coffee shop kind of conversation. Nothing was recorded. It was really just kind of a place to really network and talk semi-privately about what was going on in the industry and the game that you were playing and that kind of thing. So the topics could get kind of heated and controversial, and you know, you kind of go over into politics and religion and that kind of stuff. It's kind of hard to stay away from those things with RPGs, because RPGs are full of politics and religion. It's part of what makes them interesting. So, but yeah,
The reason why I was asking about Basic Expert is that Basic Expert has a concept that, for the most part, later iterations of Dungeons and Dragons have gone away from, which is race as class.
Right.
Which, if you're playing a dwarf, you're playing a dwarf. You have to be probably a dwarven fighter, but, you know. What's your feelings of that? I mean, you're mostly a 5e GM these days, but what's your idea on racist class?
Well, narratively, I think it's like that's the important thing. Like, if you're playing from a place where you have a race and they are very homogenous, or there's something about them that is very different, like with elf. As a race, it was the magic using, you know, was a big part of what an elf was. So I think it's a way that you could set a player apart a lot in a way that is core to what that person's makeup is. And I don't want to get into like genetics or something like that. But really that is what it is. You know, like when you're saying racist class, you're saying that this thing genetically can do this thing that other people don't, or does this thing in a certain way, or has, you know, is mostly this way. I think it's fine. A lot of what I've seen, you know, in our space, there are a lot of individuals out there that don't want to be restrained by anything, right?
Right.
But what I would say is that working from constraint is actually where you get execution. Like, you get something actually done. If you have a palette of 10 million colors, where do you start? You know, my idea is that when somebody comes into a game or something, you make the palette, you make the choices simple so that they can wrap their heads around it. And then from there, you can go. Now, I know a lot of the stuff that is in kind of the hobby space and people make themselves is for intermediate to advanced players. I would say that there are systems that are intermediate to advanced systems. And we know this. We have the basic advanced progression. There are play sets for 3.5, 5th edition, that kind of thing, that are very simple so that people can learn how to play.
Right.
And those are usually the most successful products. And it's because most people don't get past that. You know, that's enough product for most people. So I guess where I'm going from all that is just like Races class. It's a great way to simplify things, even down to not having to pick a class. You know, you have all these abilities and that kind of thing, and this is who you are, and you're going to play that, embody that.
Yeah, I mean, limitations aren't limitations like that are as limiting as you allow them to be as a player. You know, not every dwarf is in basic is going to be the same dwarf. You're going to roleplay it differently, equip them differently,
right,
have different expectations. And like you said, if you have a million color choices on your palette, how do you choose? But if you have a limited number of color choices, you know what? Colors mix. You can always, right, you know, even if you are playing a dwarven fighter or a dwarf that happens to, the default seems to be fighter, you can add some aspects to your character through equipment, 10-foot poles and other stuff that makes him more of a spelunker. A little bit of a less necessarily purely that dwarf, but checking for traps, using the mirror to pick around corners, like, you know, play them differently, make those changes in your character that makes your character different than others of the quote same race or same class. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah, what I think some of the some of it is this resistance to play an archetype. And I don't really understand that, because it's like, it seems like a lot of that comes from people that have never just sat down and been like, you know what, I'm going to make a human fighter. And I'm going to be mechanically basically as basic as it gets. But I have a persona. I have a character. There's a lot that you can do with the intangibles of an RPG that will make that character memorable or interesting.
You know, and people forget that. I've had that discussion. It's this discussion of classes goes back to, I'm sure, people who went from basic D&D, original D&D, who went to AD&D, and then from AD&D, Unearthed Arcana, adding in extra classes. Options are great, but in my experience with old-school gamers, they always seem to generally gravitate back to the original classes, the core classes, because those have the most flexibility.
Yeah, they're very pure archetypes, and it's like, you know, you've got the cleric, the fighter, the magic user, and the thief, and those are the most archetypical, I would say, across the board. I mean, I think they might be Western archetypes. You know, maybe if you're playing with somebody from a very different culture in a different part of the world, maybe they have their archetypes. And honestly, I'd be interested to, you know, play a game where the archetypes are different, but because the historical-ish context was different, that would be really cool. But it's hard, because there's a lot of barriers. There's a lot of barriers of maybe language or just culture. You know, it's hard to play outside of your culture and really portray it in a way that's authentic, because you don't know. You know, so
no, it's true. And Western fantasy role playing is based on, to a large extent, the fiction, the fables, and the lore of Western Middle Ages, which is why you don't see too many games set in Rome. It's turned, you know, in the Roman Empire, because our culture has this background that this communal history, false history, but this the lore that we look back on.
Right.
And we can relate to that, and that's, I think, it's even why I think, you know, when it comes to movies, science fiction is much more popular than fantasy.
Right.
But when it comes to fiction, the written word, it flips. It's like fantasy is your bigger. And when it comes to role-playing games, I mean, Starfinder, I'm sure, made, you know, high as own money, but I don't think it was the success they were hoping it would be, or else we wouldn't be seeing Pathfinder 2 so quickly.
Right.
Behind it.
Right. Well, it's the, I don't know. I've got a theory behind this. We can probably talk about that in the hex crawl. So.
Okay. We'll hold on to it for a moment, then we'll go on to our next question. How do you feel about Save or Die as a concept, not the podcast?
I think that Save or Die is always excellent. I think that there are things out there in the world that are just that stark of, well, you're alive or, well, you're dead. And when you're playing an RPG, it's not, you know, you're not writing a novel. You're in a world that can do things to you. And if you make bad decisions or just decisions and, you know, some, what I want to call it, like some lich, had a real interest in a certain trap that liquefied flesh. Well, maybe you're just dead. and then everybody else gets to learn from your experience. And that's what being an adventurer is all about. I mean, you don't, I feel like even in these RPG contexts, it's like you don't go out adventuring to be safe. You could do a lot of other things that are safe, right? Like you could help plow the fields and make a little bit of money, and you know, like you could make a whole RPG around, you know, a simple agrarian lifestyle, but it's not gonna really be that interesting.
Nah, that's why we have the lore. But right. not only that, I mean, you know, Save or Die, with great risk comes great reward.
Right.
And especially, I guess, not just with 5e, but with even with AD&D, higher level characters are hard to balance adventures against because they are so powerful. And something like Save or Die kind of keeps them in check a little bit, makes them think before they act. Especially if you telegraph, I mean, I always feel that Save or Die should be like, all right, you found the great MacGuffin, you found the big bad guy, and somehow it just looks too easy to approach him. Well, expect a trap.
Right.
It might be Save or Die. I never liked it when it's just you turn the corner and you step into a pit trap and it's endless.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this has to do with really... what I want to say, like creating a fun experience. Like if you are somebody that really embraces just simulation, you know, here's the world, here's what's happening, and you don't manipulate things to where it makes people excited, makes people interested, it creates mystery, stuff that wasn't there, you know, it's like,
right.
You know, we got things that can do simulation. They're called computers. Let's let them do that. And us as storytellers, we need to breathe some narrative into this space. And I think that the people that are skilled at doing that, taking what's there, changing it a bit, maybe just narratively or, you know, NPC-wise, what's going on with people or their mannerisms or those kind of things. Those are the people that create entertaining content beyond what's in the module.
Yeah, it does take skill. And the skill I had when I first came into gaming in the early 80s is certainly not the person I am now when it comes to GMing. I like to think I've learned a lot. And I've learned the pacing and the storytelling and the rules enough that I can make it an enjoyable experience. And by the way, I think you need two different skill sets or multiple different skill sets. If you're running for a campaign with your friends, if you're running in a public environment, if you're running at a convention, which is going to be a one shot. They're all different skills that are involved, because there's different pacing that you need to have. And I think a good GM learns how to do best with the group that they have. You have to adjust for your group. So, but this is probably your talk for the second half of this. Yeah, we'll hit our last question and then we'll sandbox. You came into gaming around 11 years old.
Yeah, I would say around 10, 11.
10 or 11. So you were a preteen. What would you at 10 or 11 think of what you're doing now, where you are in the hobby, what you've accomplished?
Well, about that time, actually a little bit earlier, I had a friend that I spent a lot of time with and would talk with at recess and that kind of thing. What I did when I was in recess, when I was like kind of that preteen thing, was there was the playground, and then there was this little alley that was next to where the playground was. And I mean, it was paved, but it was like roughly paved, right? But what I would do is me and my friend would walk up and down this alley. And it wasn't like, you know, between buildings or whatever. It was just like, you know, an access right there. And we would just walk up and down there, and we would talk about things. Like, we would talk about the games that we'd been playing. We'd talk about creating stories and that kind of thing. And so it was kind of like an epiphany when I found out that there were other people that did this kind of thing. You know, it's like, so I guess where I'm going from there is like, I've wanted to, well, at that point I was like, I want to make a video game company. You know what I mean? Like, that was what I was thinking I wanted to do. So it got me interested not only in creative space, but also the business space. And, so if I looked at what I was doing now versus then, I think I would be just like really proud of myself and just be like, well, we still got a long way to go, but I've proven that a certain way of monetizing this kind of game is possible.
Cool. All right. Well, you pretty much lead us right now into our sandbox. All right. Now we're in the sandbox aspect. You know, if I was a real professional podcast, this is where I would stop the first half of the podcast and then like insert an ad in the middle, but I don't do that. listen, for me, it's just pure laziness. I like to keep things simple as possible. Mm-hmm. But it's not an easy endeavor to make money in this hobby of ours. A lot of people try. There's a lot of self-publishers. There's a lot of people that freelance and people do make some, but it's not an easy road, and you've taken a different angle to it.
Let's talk about that. Sure. I kind of looked out into the landscape, and I mean, I'm creative, but I'm not the most creative person in the world. There's a lot of products out there, a lot of game systems out there that are above and beyond what I could do with maybe like a decade of work by myself. So why don't I leverage that is the way that I look at it. It's like, I've gone out, talked to the small publishers, just kind of thrown around some ideas on what I could do to help them promote their products. The issue is, it's all about competing for attention. And I've been listening to a guy named Gary Vaynerchuk very, very recently, and he's a great marketer. He does a lot of the kind of like entrepreneurial speaking and that kind of stuff, because that's what you do when you're somebody that's, you know, quote unquote on top of the game. But That's kind of what it is. It's like, you have to compete for attention, and a lot of these systems, a lot of this material, just doesn't garner the attention. Maybe not on the merits of the actual material, but just on the marketing machine that's behind them. Like, when you're competing with Hasbro, and you're just a small publisher, you can't expect to have an audience on the same scale. But you have to understand that your economics are totally different. Like, if you make, you personally could make, I mean, you know, it depends on your situation, but if you live in rural America or something like that, you could make $25,000, $30,000 a year and live pretty comfortably.
Right.
So you just have to kind of look at all of these angles of what you're doing and say, well, this product is, you know, might only do this, but if I do this, basically I'm doing what these guys are doing, because they're employing, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people in different capacities to help and push these products forward. So small business is just totally different than corporate business. And I think a lot of small business people want to try and copy what big businesses are doing, and you can't do it. They're going to win at scale.
Yeah, because you're trying to emulate a business model, like you said, that's not going to work for a one-man company when you're up against Paizo, Wizards of the Coast.
Right.
And it's not only the people working on it, but it's things like advertising resources and the fact that any announcement they make is picked up everywhere.
Right.
Within our hobby.
Yeah, and I mean, there are people that make their living, or at least, you know, like their little bit of a podcast, maybe spending money or, you know, how whatever it is in their lifestyle, reporting on that. You know, I think that's great. You know, however people are able to leverage the raw material that's out there. And that's where I think there are a lot more people that are kind of where I am, which is there's a lot of raw material out there. And when I say raw, there's a lot of work that's already been put into it. But to me, that's raw material. Like, I would say creatively, you know, making my own modules and dungeons for D&D, that was like my first creative outlet. But as I got older, that actually kind of shifted towards audio. So I started DJing. I started mixing music. And things out there. I started getting into the legal stuff around all that. And basically, okay, it's like you have to make a choice. You know, if you're using is under a regular license, you know, you can never sell it. But the way that they have it now, I mean, you can kind of leverage it to get some attention. I mean, it's just, it's hacking the system, right? Every time, you know, like there are all these walls put up by copyright and creative people and people like me that want to use this raw material to create something new and maybe leverage some of the attention that that stuff got. But really, just looking at this and be like, this is a good, like, you know, you're out in the field and you're picking carrots and you're like, this is a really nice carrot, right? So you're just, for me, it's not about how popular something is. It's about, I've used it. Can I use it to create something new, you know, alongside of whatever I'm injecting into it? And it's like, that is, you know, there are all these barriers, but you have to find your way around the barriers. But the great thing is with social media, the amount of barriers that we've ever had. So,
Social media lowers those barriers. Yeah.
Good.
No, it's like, you're right. Social media has so much lowered barriers of entry to any kind of marketing. You're limited to really your own ability to grow your audience. That's your limitation.
Okay, you just rubber banded back. You were breaking up there. I didn't hear you last.
No, I was saying that you're basically limited by your own ability to grow your audience.
Doing it again.
Gosh darn it. All right, hold on a second. I'm going to drop out real quick and drop back in. Yes, this will still be in the podcast, folks.
My Discord. Hopefully. And see if...
There we go. How's this sound now?
That sounded better.
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay, yeah.
Discord has growing pains.
That's okay. But yeah, you might want to cut that out. But then, yeah, just your last comment,
I think. Yeah, no, what I was saying is that when it comes to social media, your limitations are pretty much your ability to grow your audience. And if you can grow your audience, and if you can figure out how to do that, it's free marketing.
Right. And organic reach is part of it. But also, I mean, if you're in a situation where, you know, you're trying to figure out how to invest, or you've got other people that are trying to figure out how to invest some money that they have, I mean, just throw a proposition out for people. You don't have to make any promises. You just have to make a deal. And what I'm talking about is just, you know, like leveraging some ad space as well, along with the rest of it. And if you do both, and you have something that you believe in that creates value, like you're creating value, right? Whatever you're doing, whether you're writing or you're doing the service that I do, or any of those things, you put some money in, you know, you put $100 a month or something like that into ads, and you're going to get more attention. It's just, now you do have to make something compelling to click on or swipe on, or, you know, it just depends on what platform you're on. So there are a lot of different competencies that you have to have. Or what's a good alternative is just going out on social media, networking very widely, be willing to barter with people. Like, if you're able to do a certain thing and they want it, and they can do a certain thing that you want, there are billions of people to talk to out on the internet. You can find people that want exactly what you want, and you want exactly what they do. You just have to go out there and put in the work of looking around.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've seen a lot of that barter going on, and or even just volunteering. People just, they want to help. There's a large amount of this community that wants to help their fellow creators, and their payment is often in your goodwill. And it's amazing.
And it's really the 80-20. I mean, it's like you have to focus on what you're doing. You have to. You can't make your job helping, you know, other people unless you're doing it as, hey, I'm retired. This is something I just like to do in my spare time. You know, those kind of things. You can do, you know, you can volunteer, and that's cool. That's awesome. But you, what I mean as in the you is you as a creator, you can't get derailed from what you're doing. You have to understand that you got to put your works first, and then, yeah, have a taste and have a step into what other people are doing, and then from there, you know, you find good people to work with, collaborations, you work up, you know, like you said, tide raises all boats. It really does.
It's a beautiful thing about what's going on in this hobby, and hopefully it continues. Maybe Pathfinder 2 will give another boost to the hobby, or maybe not. I don't know.
Well, anytime you keep developing something, like if the engineering of the mechanics is actually improving people's experience, that's where these new products will flourish. If they're being over-engineered and they're just being changed to be changed, then that's where you'll see a decline. And I mean, different niches need different things. You know, the Pathfinder niche has a lot of stuff to look at, and they've embraced that. Now, does Pathfinder 2 embrace that? Who knows? I mean, they may have come out with a game that's totally different. And when you go into a space mechanically, that's totally different, or different enough to where people aren't comfortable with it, you're gonna have to close. And what I mean by that is, like, you're going to have to get these people to convert. And how do you do that? Well, it has to be something they want. Like, this is the thing. People think that marketing and sales is going to sell something that's not good in the first place. That's not what marketing and sales is. Marketing and sales is to get more attention on something that's already good.
Right.
And so everybody out there that wants to just, you know, blindly grow their followers or something like that and not produce anything, that's a mistake. you have to spend 20% of your time-ish on promoting, and then 80% on what you're doing. So it's kind of like, it's almost like a nested 80-20, right? It's like, you have the 80-20, this 80% is on what I'm doing, this 20% is on what other people are doing, and then in that 80%, 20% of that, it should be promotion, 80% of that should be content creation.
Well, that actually makes sense. And I got a question for you then. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the big boys. We're talking about Wizards of the Coast. We're talking about Paizo. Mm-hmm. And how it's impossible to really compete on their levels. But if you find your own
niche,
your own niche, your own corner of the universe, mm-hmm. are you and you can be number one or number two in your niche. Personally, in my opinion, I think that puts you in a much stronger position than somebody who is competing against the big boys in the industry, yeah. and not coming anywhere close to them.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you're trying to clone something. This is what I tell people, really, is like, if you're trying to clone something, you better have more money than the guy that you're cloning. Or in money, resources, connections. I mean, you know, you better have more capital altogether than the person you're cloning, or else it's not going to work. It's just not.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of it this way. Like, somebody can have an idea, a concept, like, to just kind of use the video game thing, because almost everybody plays some of these games. I play them too. The newer FPS games like Fortnite and PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, all those came from a game, the first game that did something like this. And because there was a technology limitation before this happened, there was a game called H1Z1, and this was like a zombie shooter game. But they ended up putting a mode in it where you could get, like, I can't remember what their cap was, but a lot of people in a free-for-all match where the arena kept getting smaller and smaller. It was the first real game to do that kind of thing successfully. So what happened was that game was not really successful, but the idea of Battle Royale, which is what that's called, you don't get to see the birth of a new gaming genre very often. And this is really the birth of a new gaming genre.
So, and I'll be honest with you, you probably don't even recognize it as the birth when it's happening. It's in
right,
retrospect.
You don't, but who recognized it were different teams, like the Epic Games team that made Fortnite, the PlayerUnknown's team that made PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, the, those were the earlier ones, and then now you have Apex Legends, which is kind of like the new EA thing, but EA was not going to do it until somebody else had already established the market, because they're the biggest, so they can make a clone of Fortnite and PUBG and H1Z1 after the market is established. They're able, because of their size, to wait until it's the right moment for them to start developing something. And really, it's like, they probably didn't wait. They probably saw H1Z1. They probably had people that played it, and they were probably like, this is new. This is a new genre. This is a, I mean, it's not a completely new gaming experience because it's still FPS, but it's new enough to where people are out of their minds for it, right? So it's the time for them to start developing. And then they get on their 2-3-4 year development cycle, and they're going to repurpose things from different games, you know, just development wise.
Right.
And they can launch and they can be the biggest. They don't have to be first. They can be the second mouse that gets the cheese. So I guess what I'm saying, how that relates to RPGs, it's just kind of a different thing. It's like, if you're trying to clone D&D, if you want to be the thing that everybody plays, you have to, you have to have more leverage. But if you're doing something like Swords and Wizardry, which is basically like, I would call that more like a reboot of something, you know.
Oh yeah.
It's more of a repurposing of something to be able to do something legally, basically. And so I think that's fine. And but you know your niche, right? And you know the cons, and you know your environment, and that's the environment. Now, is that ever going to be, you know, are you ever going to be a multi-billionaire from, you know, doing OSR? Probably not. But if you enjoy it and, you know, you can support your lifestyle and everything around whatever else. The hobbyist community to me is just, it's fantastic. Like, I just feel like with a lot of these things, and I'm kind of talking now more from like the streaming side of things, the performance side of things.
Right.
People watch Ninja and they watch Shroud and they watch these people that have hundreds of thousands of viewers. But if you go out into the space where people are like, you know, they have 5 viewers, they have 12 viewers, they have 15 viewers, they may have a great show. But you have to go out and explore to find that great stuff. It's kind of like, you know, it's just like anybody that would go to music festivals or, you know, like journalism, basically. You know, there's a lot of space to do journalism on these things. You know, it's almost like the before they were famous kind of thing. Because if you do journalism on like 800 people and you make enough of a connection where they know who you are and you did something for them, like you said, the volunteering, like what I've been doing is I go into Twitch channels and I clip people when they have a great moment, because maybe they're not going to do it. You know, maybe they miss something. Maybe they don't do it fast enough because they're still streaming. You're clipping it right now. It's relevant in the moment, you know? So that's how I've leveraged trying to build my brand is, you know, I have the things that I do, the mixing and the audio production, and I'm going to be putting out some content around those things. But, and then I have the pro GMing stuff that I have done, and it's a gig job. You know, sometimes you have gigs flowing out your ears, and sometimes you don't work for 4 months. So, just being a serial entrepreneur, having those small things, figuring out how you can help people to where they want to help you. I don't know. Some people might be against that. They might just be like, well, somebody should just love you for who you are and blah, blah, blah. It's like, look, that's not how it works in business. It's value for value in business. And the more value that you give, the more value that's you should get in return. It doesn't work like that all the time. But basically, if you didn't get the value of somebody wants to help you or somebody comes and subscribes to your channel or something like that, you built your personal skill. Like, I'm building my skill on being able to clip things faster. I'm building my skill with multiple social media platforms. Even if these things don't bring me value out in the marketplace, they bring me marketable value for myself. I can tell somebody, oh yeah, I've done that. Oh yeah, I did that. Oh yeah, I've worked with that platform. Sorry, I'm kind of a rambler. So
no, dude, it's fine, man. It's like I said before the show, this goes where it goes, man. That's fine. But I guess like any other aspect of this industry, if you want to be successful, it also requires a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication.
Right.
You know, without it, if you are putting in, you know, less than full effort to be successful, you're not going to be successful.
What I like to say is that you can put in part time, but you got to put in full effort, right? Like, if you got other things in your life that take priority, it's fine. But try and also make yourself a priority, set some time aside, you know, to do these kind of things. You know, we got like 3 things that we usually juggle. You know, we've got personal commitments, what we have to do for employment, and then all the other things that we want to work on. I mean, if you're working on building something, you're really just sacrificing leisure time. You know, it's like, and some people will look at my stream if I'm doing a streaming thing or something like that and be like, well, he's playing a game. It's like, but you're playing it with purpose, right? You're playing it to entertain. Right. You're playing it to market. You're playing it to promote. There's the intent is the thing that is really important. I mean, you were a police officer, so you understand, yep. You know, intent.
You know, definitely.
An accident is different than, you know, like premeditated something. So
right.
It's the same thing. It's like, you know, if you can do anything with purpose where you're learning, getting better, developing. And nowadays, people are just interested in the story. And if you present it, like, you know, the storytelling aspect of being a dungeon master has really been something that's shaped, you know, what I've wanted to do to create value in the world. So the storytelling just goes into social media. It just goes into everything that I'm trying to do for myself and for the people around me. And that's how you build community. It's how you build whatever you're doing. I mean, there is... That's part of everything. Like, if I had a different job, like if I was stacking boxes somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and I could figure out a way to leverage showing people how to stack boxes efficiently in an entertaining way, then you're creating content, and it's around something that is relevant to whatever business you're in. Me personally, it's like my family's been all like military people and worked for the government and that kind of thing, so. All this business stuff has been on my own. Like, I didn't have a family to show me how to do this stuff, you know? I've just been really passionate about wanting to do it for so long.
Well, that's interesting. And the idea that, I mean, for me, I was slow to fully come into certain social media. I was slow to join Facebook. I was resistant. Because my generation didn't grow up on this. I mean, I graduated high school in 85. Right. I was thrilled to have a beeper. When you know, you found those beeper hacks, like, all right, well, you know, you can what words can you send via the beeper?
Or right. it's funny. It's like along with that, though, but I think of, like, you know, where you're talking about, the timetable that you're talking about, and it's like, I feel like I missed the boat on a lot of things. Like, I missed the boat on programming, right? Like, it wasn't even in my mind, okay? My aunt, when I was, let's see, how old was I? When I was, like, 6, 7 years old, right? She had a Commodore 64 that she did word processing on, right? And they had a you know, that she had Jumpman, you know, she had they had an you know, there was an Atari 2600 in my house, but it was like I was too young, and the culture as it was changing was not pushing me towards, well, you need to learn a skill. It was pushing me towards, you need to get good grades in school. So it's like me thinking about programming at that point, it wasn't even on my radar, because everybody was just like, well, just go study math and science, and then you'll go to college, and then you'll have a great job. And it's like, and I kind of bought into that. And so I didn't think about these other things, you know, as skills. I thought of them as, oh, well, that's a computer sitting over there. You know, so
it's hobbyist. That's, yeah. You know, I mean, listen, I got my BA in history because you were told you're going to college and you're going to get a BA or and whatever. And
right.
Default was history because I was a gamer. And again, you know, fantasy gaming is built upon, you know, Middle Ages and Renaissance, you know, lore. Right. So I've tried to go in for the history of it.
Right. But yeah, I actually did a Revolutionary War reenacting when I was growing up. My parents like that. So I did get a taste of that disconnection from technology, you know. And I
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I kind of it's compartmentalizing. It's like I do a lot with social media and online and that kind of thing. But when I sit down at a table with people, there's no phone to be found. You know, it's like if I have to bring it because, you know, somebody might have an emergency or something like that. It's in my phone on vibrate, or like in my pocket on vibrate.
Right.
If I go out with somebody to, you know, like to dinner or something like that, I just can't believe, I don't socialize a lot with people in person, but like, I just can't believe how they're just like on Instagram, you know, like they're not enjoying each other's company. They're kind of like, you know, they've come together, because it's like a routine thing that they do, but they could be on their phone on Instagram, you know, like at home. So, I do see that, you know, having the ability to compartmentalize, have a conversation, with somebody in person, why that is so marketable right now, because most people don't know how to do it.
No, you know what? And there's a large amount of truth to that, because listen, even when my wife and I go out to dinner, okay, or yesterday we went out to brunch at our local pub and we settled in, you know, within 5 minutes, and neither one of us hitting Facebook, but my wife's on her phone checking job opportunities because she wants to get out of her fucking job like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. And I'm checking out sports news on my phone because they got the college basketball game on, and I'm looking mm-hmm. for updates as we're waiting for our food. Right. And then when the food came, we conversed. But during mm-hmm. that waiting period, and now, admittedly, it's my wife. We live together. We spend a lot of time together.
Sure.
But, and if I'm hitting up with, if I'm hanging out with somebody like, I don't know, Joe the lawyer, when we get together every couple of months, she's up in Connecticut, I'm down in New York yeah. City, phones don't come out. We're talking and catching up. But there is that aspect of when you're running a game, I haven't had this problem really at conventions, but I would have this issue running at a game store with a regular group mm-hmm. that, if the pacing slowed down or somebody felt disengaged, I guess.
Right. They got to be engaged in something else.
Yeah. The phone comes out and it's part of the, I guess, the new reality.
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, the way that I try and frame it is like, I'm not going to tell you how to live your life, but I will talk about how, you know, things can shape you, right? Like if you're always just on your phone looking at what everybody else is doing, you're a pass. I guess this was a meme that came out or whatever, but it's true. If you're just looking down feeds and just like kind of replying or whatever, and you're not making anything, you're not doing anything, you're an NPC in the world. You know what I mean? Like you're an NPC in the world of reality. Right. And that's okay, you know, to just chill out and do some of that a little bit. But when it's all that you do, you're everything's just passing you by. Now, I know that a lot of people would look at what I do and be like, well, you're just wasting your time. It's like, well, buddy, if I could tell you how much research that I've done, how much work that I've put into this screwing around, you would not believe it. And these kind of things, you know, there's an explosion of, you know, notoriety or business or whatever, but it comes after, you know, 10, 15 years of work.
Oh, yeah, nothing. It's strange because I see people that come into the hobby and they want to be creators or social media bloggers or whatever. And they come into it, and then they're like, well, I don't have a following. And it's like, well, just so you know, it took me 10 years to get where I'm at now. And that wasn't just because – that was hard work and persistency right. and time. You don't jump into something – or I shouldn't say you don't. You rarely does anybody jump into something and have immediate success.
Right.
Because I mean, – especially in an industry where you need a customer base,
yeah.
You know, it takes time to build that. You don't inherit it usually.
Right. Well, everybody just wants the attention. They don't understand how to get the attention, and it's okay. Like the way that I've done it or seen it, what I'm doing right now is I'm networking with people that, you know, all they're doing is kind of pushing buttons and following each other. And some, and that's called follow for follow. And a lot of people look down on that. A lot of people look down on the community of people that just, you know, get pump up their numbers, basically. Right. But I'm telling you, it's like cold calling. You know, I don't know how much like marketing or sales that you've ever done or are aware of from, you know, your work in the industry of, you know, helping to get some of the stuff put out. But it's definitely cold calling. It's like, from what I've seen, I mean, people are like, well, you should just join a community and you should have a relationship with those people and you should blah, 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 blah. It's like, look, if those people are not really helping me do what I want to do, I want to find somebody motivated. All right. Even these follow for follow people, what you do is you get in there, you follow a bunch of people, you see who's making stuff, you DM them, which is direct message. I don't know right. if you're down with the lingo.
I'm down with the lingo. Not everybody listening might be down with the lingo.
Right. Right. So I'll
you
go.
You dungeon master them? What the hell are you talking about?
Exactly. So that's the other reason that I clarify, because it kind of like overlaps so much with our hobby. But yeah, so you DM people, and you even if it's just a little thing that you start off with somebody, just like, hey, thanks for following. Hey, you know, like what you're doing, that's really cool. You know, when do you do it? You know, like when, like ask, be interested in what they're doing along with what you're doing, and you are creating a familiar what I want to call it, kind of like that
personal connection.
Yeah, like that Dunbar's number connection, right? Like those 150 people that you can say, hey, I know you, like if you were walking into a room, right? So you just work on that close group, because that's what we can handle as humans, you know? And then, but to get to that 150 people that will be like, hey, how you doing? And every once in a while come by and be like, oh man, great stream. You're having a lot of fun. We're, you know, you're entertaining me. You know, they don't say this, but this is what they're thinking, right? You know, and you're talking and interacting. To build that group, you're gonna have to talk to like 1,000 times that many people by just going out on the internet and seeing who's just trying to capture some attention just like you.
Yeah.
You know? But they're capturing attention because they're doing something, right? excuse me.
Yeah.
You got to go out there, do the work, put in the work. Like a lot of people are like, oh, I don't like follow for follow, blah, blah, blah. It's because they don't like doing the work. It's a lot of work to click that many buttons and throw out that many DMs and care. But you care enough to where you want them to see what their reaction back to you is. If you never get a reaction back, you're probably, you know, that connection is nothing to you.
It's like when I started the blog, Ten Cars Tavern, you had to do the footwork to get out. You know, you can start a blog. Nobody's going to know about your blog just by you starting it.
Right.
I participated in forums. Mm-hmm. I participated in other blogs and had some great conversations. And that is the way organically you're growing your connections. And then you hit a critical mass at some point. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that critical mass point is, where suddenly it grows on its own. It doesn't need the additional. Now you can focus on, like you said, those 150 people, but those 150 right. people are still bringing in more readers or more viewers right. for you.
Well, those 150 people are like your cohort. Like those are like they're farther away than like a close friend or somebody that, like a close collaborator, somebody you work with all the time, but they are somebody where, you have enough of a relationship. Maybe you've done some work with them. Maybe you did something for them cool and they liked you because of that. That I would say that's kind of what I would tell somebody to target, but usually you probably want to double your target. So if you have like 300 people that you have communicated with, you do communicate either through your social media or actually working on stuff together on a regular basis and you, you know, like doing forum posts, that kind of stuff. That is social media communication. That's just an older style. So once you build that, those aren't fans, right? So this is what I would tell people too, is like, you got two parts to your audience. Your first audience is somebody that is going to be working shoulder to shoulder with you. You know, you're building a, I don't want to call it a team, but you're building kind of like a, I guess community is the right word, you know, but those first people in the community are going to be working. Like, they're workers, they're makers, they're working. Like, you know, the way that you've built your community is perfect because you've got so many people that are really, you know, they make stuff. They put value out there. So, and then after you build that, then you're gonna start seeing attention, and you'll get some attention before then. But after that, you know, you'll start getting the attention. Now, the interaction with your audience instead of your cohort is very different. You know, like, people feel like they have to be very personable with the fan. You don't have to be very personable with a fan. They like what you make. They don't know you. They don't. Like, your cohort, some of them, they might know you. You know, like, the close people, maybe the top 10 people that you work with all the time, they will know you. Everybody else, they don't need to know you because they know your content. You know, so you want to have a relationship with them. You want to reach out to them. You want to answer them if they are really excited about talking to you or interacting with you, or are like, hey, look at this, this might help you out, you know, because you'll start getting that kind of stuff. That's all great. It's good feedback. But you have to understand there's a huge gap between, you know, those people. They're going to want access to you, right? They're going to be like, hey, Tankar, I'm just talking in general right now, but like, you know, hey, Tankar, you want to go out for coffee? It's like, you're probably not going to go out for coffee with the guy because you can only see so many people. You can only interact with so many people. And but if you were at a con and you were having like you had a table at a booth at a con, and they came up and were like, hey, this is awesome, can I get a selfie with you, Eric? You know, like that kind of thing. I'm sure you would want to do that. And it has to do with how much energy you have. Well, I've been doing that
because my relationship with Frog Guy Games, I get to go to, it's going to be 4 full weekend cons a year, and since I started going to conventions, I've had people come up to me and shake my hand, and their loyal readers. Now that I've been doing the podcast, I have people calling out my name from 10 feet behind me because they recognize the voice.
Right.
Which is a totally different, it's like, huh?
Yeah.
Like, and because of the podcast, people get to know me differently than just because of the blog. Because now they hear me. It's a bit more intimate than
audio's powerful.
So they certainly do know me better than people that just knew me from the blog. And it's a different experience. It's very it's rewarding. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the compensation that I certainly enjoy having for doing all this stuff with the blog and the Discord, mm-hmm, and the podcast.
Right. And I would just say that the thing that a lot of people go wrong with, I've seen on social media, is if you're out there promoting, if you're out there, you know, like putting your content out there and you're never asking for anything in return, the reason you need to do that is because you need resources to be able to live, and you need resources to be able to interact with your community. You know, if you don't have the ability to go out there and interact with your community, but you have all these people that know who you are, but you're working 2 jobs and you're living in San Francisco, and you know, every moment, like I'm actually speaking from a specific thing that I read. It was an article about a girl that did, you know, like, she did all this makeup stuff and promotion, and you know, like, did all these videos on social media and stuff. Right. And even with monetization and that kind of stuff, because of where she was, she had nothing. Like she was penniless, basically. And so she was doing it for the straight attention. She was doing it for the straight self-aggrandizing attention. And that's, to me, that's tragic, because it's like, yeah, she was able to, get this big audience, but she wasn't able to negotiate with the folks that she was doing things with to be able to turn that into something where she doesn't have to wait tables. And to me, that's tragic. You know, it's like all she would need is like, you know, a little bit of guidance, work, you know, do a little bit of that trade-off and that kind of thing, and make something of that instead of being stuck in that situation forever.
Yeah, but sometimes people only see what's directly in front of them. They don't see the wider picture.
Yeah.
And I think that in this case, she got caught in her own immediate situation.
Well, because it feels good. You know, you get that. You get that that attention, and the attention itself is a reward also. But we all got to put food on the table, you know.
Oh yeah. And
I know nowadays there's a lot of help, you know, if you're disabled or that kind of thing, compared to pretty much everywhere else in the world and compared to like other times in history, no matter where you are, as long as you're decent and you show yourself to be decent to a few people around you, you're going to have a roof over your head. You know, you're going to be able to have enough money to feed yourself, or, you know, do the things that you need to do to be able to subsist. But then from there, you got to figure something out. And, you know, I'm talking to people that are capable. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
if you're disabled or something like that, to the point where you can't do anything, then that's one thing. But like, if you're just really young, you know, don't really have anything, or, you know, you've hit a rough patch in your life or something like that, you know, it's so much, you can actually pick yourself up nowadays. I wouldn't say that about other times in history.
No, there's a lot of opportunities these days, and social media, the internet, self-publishing, retail places like Drive-Thru have lowered the bar.
Right.
You know, and I frequently tell people, like, you know, people that have published on RPG Now / Drive-Thru, and they put out their stuff for free. And listen, everybody loves free, but they don't always value free.
Yeah, that's the big thing. You have to price something at what it's worth.
And even if you want to give something away, I've always told people, you know, Drive-Thru has a pay what you want option.
Right.
And it serves two purposes. It allows people to effectively donate for what would have been a free product. But also, the secret that a lot of people don't realize is if you offer something for free on Drive-Thru, it will never rank. You will never see it get copper or silver in the sales rankings, but pay what you want will. Even copies that people pay $0 for count for that sales. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great tip for anybody that's out there that makes and puts out on that platform. And these are the kind of things, right? Just getting your hands dirty or doing the research to listen to people that have gotten their hands dirty on this kind of thing, you know, coming into Tinker's Tavern and trying, you know, getting to the networking society after you've shown that you've made a few things. It's a great way to save a lot of time. You know, it's like, and that's us using our 20% to help each other out. And that's a really good, specific example. And the people that are on, that are doing crowdfunding, I mean, I saw a GDC presentation where they were talking about, the differences between, you know, these, crowdfunded things and, people that are just game designers, and that's all they do. So, in the crowdfunding space, those people are learning how to do everything. You know, they're learning about marketing. They're learning about distribution. They're learning about, maybe even a little bit of PR or whatever outside of the actual designing of their game. Now, that does take away time from being able to put your product together, but it lets you understand. You're getting an education, you know, if you really think about it, you know, lets you understand the publishing side of things. So when you understand it, now you have knowledge that is leverage to go present your next thing to publishers first instead of doing another Kickstarter. Because even if you made a little bit less money on that Kickstarter than you would have if you didn't have a publisher, or like, you know, instead of going with Kickstarter, you went with publisher,
right,
and you didn't get so much money in the door. Well, once you understand overhead and you understand not just what is it, like financial capital, but like time capital, you know, like understanding how much your time is worth, then you're able to leverage what you do well. You're able to leverage what that publisher does well, and you're both going to benefit. That's what capitalism is all about. And some people might be like, well, these artists aren't getting paid anything and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, there's a lot of moving parts behind all that, these things, you know, actually out the door and sold to, and really at that point, you're selling business to business. You're not even selling direct to a consumer. You're selling to stores that want what you're doing so that they can distribute. Now, there's a lot of direct sales out there, but it's still, you know, when we're talking about like board games or something like that, the bulk of those sales are going to go out to retailers, whether they're online retailers or, you know, like a physical retailer.
I am right now wrestling with the dog in my arms. She's like, Daddy, it's been too long. It's been too long.
Yeah.
She's actually usually very, very good, but and she usually waits for the certain keywords where I'm signing out of an episode. But I think she got a little impatient.
That's all right. I could probably talk about this for like the next 8 hours, you know.
Well, we might have to bring it back then.
Well, I'd love that. And yeah, that would be great. And I guess really I just wanted to kind of get out the big main ideas of like, you know, what can people that are in your audience that are, you know, working on things, or the people that support those people that are working on things, you know, like, to get them to encourage them to be like, this was awesome. We'd love to see you all, you know, like distributed all over, you know, talk to a publisher, you know, that kind of thing.
Now, Kevin, if people want to see, what is a public website that they can find your work at?
So when it comes to public stuff that I've made, the best thing for them to listen to would be the ProGM podcast. I've made 2 episodes of it. It's on Anchor. So that's anchor.fm/ProGM podcast. And when it comes to other things that I've done, I have not practiced what I've preached when it came to social media for a long time. I've done remixes of things and that kind of thing. I'm getting some new equipment here pretty shortly. So what I'm going to be doing is starting to put more of that stuff up on YouTube. It may be under a different name, but I'm going to try and tie everything that I do together. Your ProGM is just one of the brands that I've been trying to develop.
Okay. Well, I will make sure that I include a link to your Anchor in the show notes to this Anchorcast.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good information very specifically about how I started being a ProGM, what I did, where I went, and how somebody else might be able to also do that kind of thing.
Excellent. Well, like I said, I'll mention to Pex that we got to bring you back. We got a lot more to talk about, it was a good time.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Eric. I was really super excited to sit down with you, and I really wish I had more to show, but it's kind of like I explained it to Pex. I was like, you know, what I do, it's kind of like being a fortune teller. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, you know, it's behind closed doors. I don't record anything.
The Wizard of Oz. I got you.
Yeah, kind
of. Don't you got to peek behind the curtain. Well, next time we'll peek behind the curtain a bit more.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, again, folks, as always, thank you for listening. Thanks to Kevin for being here. I will talk with you all tomorrow. As always, God bless and be well. Later, folks.